Welcome to today's sessions on sustainable agricultural practices. My name is Luther Smith. I'm Director of Professional Development and Business Relations for the American Society of Agronomy. And our hosts today are our four communities in ASA, nutrient management, soil and water, integrated pest management, and crop management. And today's sessions will incorporate all four competencies areas of being a certified crop advisor and touch on the sustainable aspects in those. So throughout the day, you'll hear different perspectives in those competency areas. So we're going to start off this morning. Our first topic is nutrient water management tools in a water short world. Brian Hopkins, Brigham Young University, and Neil Hansen, Brigham Young University, will be our two speakers. And I'll turn it over to Brian.
Good morning. I kind of figured 8 o'clock in the morning after the election, most people have stayed up too late. Some of them probably celebrated, and some of them probably drank away their sorrows. So I'm glad anybody's even here. So it's good to be here with you this morning. I'm enthused about this topic. We're definitely entering into some greater concerns in terms of water management and as well as nutrient management. We're going to focus on water scarcity today, but my own research has begun to take a little bit of a shift towards applying a lot of the nutrient management things that I've done over the years in terms of how that impacts water use and water use efficiency. So to get started, I'm going to turn some time over to Neil. We're going to kind of tag team a little bit. He's going to talk about some principles and a few case studies, and then I'll step in with some more case studies. So, Neil?
All right. Thank you, Brian. Let me just say a couple simple things to set the stage or remind why we're worried about water. There's evidence it's all about of scarcity of water resources. These are two satellite images of Lake Mead, one from 1984, since that time till 2016, we've continued to decrease in water level. We're at an all-time low since the original filling of the reservoir. We can talk about the High Plains Aquifer. This is an image, a map on the right that shows water level changes from 1950 to 2007. And you see these colors on the map, particularly down in the southern plains, that represent between 20 and 50 meters of decline in that aquifer. So there's a couple of evidences. Things that are driving this water scarcity, the list could be long, but you could kind of categorize them into things like population growth. Here's a table that shows an example for Colorado. In the South Platte River Basin, which includes Denver and North, anticipated population growth up through the year 2030 is about 65%. The state estimates 409,000 acre-feet of water needed to meet those additional urban needs. And for the most part, that water is coming from existing water users. There's not a lot of new water to be developed, and agriculture's the biggest holder of water, and since that's the case, it's also the greatest at risk for losing access. And these are exchanges, willing exchanges, buyers and sellers, but still it represents a societal and collective change of water away from agriculture. As I said, this pie chart just reflects the large share. If you look, this is nationally integrating over both western and eastern states, but this part of the pie right here represents the irrigation share of water on a national basis. In the west, it's much higher than that. So agriculture is a large water user, and we live in a water-scarce world. So that kind of sets the stage for what Brian and I want to talk about, this challenge that we have of increasing food and fiber production, even in the face of declining availability of water resources. And our presentation is focusing on that we think a part of this recipe for addressing water scarcity is actually looking at nutrient management together with water management. In the plenary session to these meetings, Sandra Postel was using this phrase frequently, more crop per drop. I phrase that as crop water productivity. And in this presentation, I'll talk about that several times. It's basically the idea of expressing crop production as a function of the water consumed. We're used to talking about agricultural productivity on a land basis, bushels per acre, tons per hectare. The idea of crop water productivity is to put the water consumption in the denominator. And so as we go through this presentation, I'll talk about that. If water is truly going to become a limiting resource and a scarce resource, we need to be thinking about assessing more regularly in our agricultural communities water productivity. So let me give an example of that, and also in this example kind of illustrate how one example of how we might get a little optimism of how are we going to do this? How are we going to increase productivity in an era of water scarcity? This example comes from dryland farming, particularly in the Great Plains, the central Great Plains. I argue that one of the ways to reduce the demand on irrigation is to increase the productivity in our dryland and rain-fed systems. If we can meet more of the agricultural demand in those systems, there's less need for expanding or developing irrigation further. I was part of a team in Colorado that worked on a long-term experiment on the eastern plains of Colorado. This was started by Dr. Gary Peterson in 1986, and it was a relatively simple study, but quite elegant and beautiful in the way it was done. The study laid out three locations across the eastern plains that had a pretty steep gradient. They had similar annual rainfall, but the northern site significantly cooler than the southern site, so there's different evaporative demand at these sites. And then at each site, the basic premise of the experiment was how frequently should we fallow? The traditional production system there is a two-year rotation with a single crop, so it's a winter wheat, summer fallow rotation, one crop every 2 years. The idea was if you convert this to a no-till system and conserve more of that soil water, could you intensify the rotation? So the first level of intensification was a wheat-corn fallow, so two crops in 3 years, a wheat-corn-millet fallow, which is three crops in 4 years, and you get the idea that it's reducing the frequency of fallow or increasing the intensity of cropping. And this is the basic outcome of that study after, this is a long-term data set, like I said, about 25 years of data. To understand this graph, the yields are annualized. What that means is if you take that wheat fallow system, take the wheat yield, but you got to divide it by two because it took 2 years to get it. Or in the wheat corn, you'd take the wheat and corn, add them together, divide by three. So that's what these are. They put it on an annual basis. And this is a simple bar graph, but it's pretty exciting. The numbers that I've put at the top of each bar is the crop water productivity. It's kilograms per cubic meter of water consumed. And again, this is rain fed, so all of these systems received the same precipitation. And it shows that by just altering the management at the system's levels, changing the crop rotation, we're producing more crop per drop. Right, so almost in these more intensive systems, nearly doubling the crop water productivity. I think it's a great story. It's just something to think about is, okay, we can analyze our systems, look at the crops that we're producing, the loss of water due to evaporation, and try and maximize the amount of water that's going through a plant rather than evaporating from the surface and be more productive. Okay, so the lesson, kind of direct lesson from this is that reducing fallow frequency improved crop water productivity. And I throw that out as an initial example to kind of help you think about this idea of expressing yield on a water basis. Now, there's another piece to this study that I think is really important, and here's the principle I'd like to illustrate. The idea of having a baseline water productivity function. So what I've expressed here from that same dry land study is a function of evapotranspiration. That's the crop water use, and the yield that came as an association with that. So each point is a given year, and this is all wheat yield. And this is a mix. Some of these come from the wheat from the wheat corn fallow, some from the wheat fallow system. I just took the wheat yields themselves, said how much water did it take to produce the grain, and what was the yield. And if you look at the relationship there, you might think about drawing a line across the maxima, kind of the top end of those yields. Think about that line as a water productivity function. This is saying, hey, if everything goes right, if the production environment is good, I can pretty much predict what the yield would be based on how much water is in that system. Okay, so that's the idea of a water productivity function. Why is it useful? The reason why I think it's useful is that we can take a water productivity function and then evaluate points that are falling below that line. So here I've circled two points. One hitting right on the line is giving you about 0.7 kilograms per meter cubed, kilograms of wheat grain for every meter cubed of water consumed. But the point that I've circled down below it shows a similar water consumption. It used about the very same amount of water, but it fell way below. And the question that you should ask yourself is, what happened? Why did this point fall down? And why did all of these other points that fall below the line, why are they not achieving their water-limited yield potential? And so actually a student and I went through this exercise. We went back through 25 years of field notes and said, hey, let's look at every single point that falls below the line and figure out what's going on. And as you might guess, some of these things were, we had a weed outbreak, there was a disease, a late frost, things that you couldn't do anything about. But the one I've listed in bold is we found consistently in those notes occurrences where we were having planting and emergence problems. And that's something that you can do something about. And so the idea was just by looking at points that fell below this water productivity baseline gave us a tool to evaluate our production management system. And we worked very hard in our own production and in the research to improve our equipment, to get better seed placement, better row cleaning, and we're doing better. We're hitting that line more frequently. And we've taken this information to area producers, dryland farmers, and shared that information with them. And they're also putting some priority on planting and emergence management as a way to try and reach that productivity. Okay, so the point I wanted to make here on the second part of this dryland is, again, just obtaining a water productivity function has some value. I do want to point out, here's a piece of this same idea, water productivity function, taken from some scientists in Australia. And they review the literature, and you can see these different colors of points. I guess the main point is that that water productivity function is dependent on your environment. So you can't just borrow one from somebody else necessarily. You need a fairly regionalized water productivity function to use as your baseline. Now, let's say you want to develop, if you agree with me, and you want to start thinking about yield per unit of water use, how in a simple way from an agricultural producer or crop consultant standpoint, how can you come up with that ET number? And I'm just going to throw out two suggested ways, and hopefully one of these makes sense in your application. The first is what I call a water balance method. And this long equation that I put across the center of the slide here is the water balance. It really essentially says all the water going into your agricultural system, which would come in the form of precipitation or irrigation, has to go into one of these bins. That water going in is going to become evapotranspiration, runoff, drainage, or it's going to either stay in the soil, or you might actually have had some water in the soil at the beginning that needs to be part of that equation. If you take that equation and just rearrange it, what we set out for was, hey, how much crop water use did we have? Well, we already know the yield, we're measuring that. We know the land area, but I want you to express your yield per unit of water. So how do you come about doing that? Well, you could just rearrange this equation, solving for evapotranspiration, which is the same as crop water use. And then if I back up a little bit, the thing that makes it easiest is if you're in an environment where you feel comfortable assuming that the runoff and the drainage are zero. If you've managed things or if the environment is such, and a lot of times in the western states we can get away with that. There are techniques and tools to estimate runoff and drainage, but those aren't things typically on a farm setting that they're being measured. So they can be estimated. But for the simplicity of demonstrating this point, let's assume that they're zero. So really what you need to do is you need a rain gauge to measure your rain. You need note-taking, pretty good records on your irrigation, whether that's a digital system that you've got or you're keeping a notebook. And then the hardest part of this equation is trying to figure out how much water did the crop use that was banked in the soil at the start of the growing season. And so what we have been doing in our research and could be adapted to a production setting is we measure the water content of the soil across the root zone at planting and at harvest time. There's a picture of one of my graduate students doing just that. He's using a neutron probe meter. But this could be done with the field method or gravimetric sampling. And here's the basic idea of what that would look like. This is an example using corn. And the root zone here for corn, we went all the way to 6 feet. You would have to decide how deep you're going, what the root zone of your crop is. We took a sample every foot, figured out the water content, and the yellow line here is the amount of water stored across depth in the soil at planting. And this other color-haired line with the triangles is at harvest time. It's really the space between those two lines that we need to add to our water balance. That's the amount of water that was consumed by the crop during the growing season from the soil. This is just another example. These were two different irrigation regimes, and it's kind of interesting when we went to a limited regime, the plant was more effective at extracting water from the soil than when it was fully irrigated, which is actually one of the cool principles is when you tighten your irrigation up a little bit, the crop will use water already in the soil more effectively. Okay, so that was the water balance method. The other way you might do this is using what I would call an energy balance. It's an equation that takes data from a weather station and calculates the evapotranspiration based on a reference condition and a crop coefficient. I'm not going to teach how to do that, but I do want to point out that in many areas of the country, there are online data services that can provide this. So this is one for Colorado. It's the Colorado Agricultural Meteorological Network. Here I've just picked an example from their website using a Colorado State weather station. It's 6 miles north of Fort Collins, and it shows here on the 16th of June this past summer what the evapotranspiration was for a corn crop, and I had to tell it when I planted my crop, when I asked for this data. Here's a small grain that's much more mature in June towards the end of its life cycle using more water. So you could get these, if they're available in your area, from a website and just keep a tally of the evapotranspiration. You could even calculate that at the end of the season to get that water use number. Okay, I'm going to give one more example and then give Brian an opportunity to share some of his. This is a project working on in Colorado on the concept of controlled deficit irrigation. And what it's used for in this presentation is to illustrate the importance of timing of water or water stress relative to critical growth stages of the crop. And in this experiment, we were doing no-till production, doing everything we could to try and be conservative on water. And in the controlled deficit irrigation, we pretty much limited irrigations to critical growth stages, and I'll show you how that looks. This is just this slide illustrating the experimental treatments. We had a well-watered control, this controlled deficit irrigation system I'm going to explain. We also had a reference drought scenario. It was just exactly 60% of the well-watered system at the same timing. In these two charts, each of the bars is an irrigation event. Starting at, you know, planting of corn through harvest, you can see in a well-watered scenario we're irrigating a dozen times or so during the season. And I broke that season up into these, what I call, key growth stages of the crop. Seed establishment is critical. If you plant a seed into dry soil, we all know what's going to happen. And towards the end of the growth cycle, when this is tasseling and silking, the reproductive growth stages are very critical. If you have drought stress during that time, your yields are going to be very poor. But in this middle time period, what I call non-critical, and what I mean, I don't know if that's a good word, it's really a less sensitive time period for the corn. These irrigations, if your water's scarce, could be delayed or skipped to conserve water for the critical growth stage. So that's what we do in this controlled deficit irrigation scenario. If you just look here, we've eliminated those irrigations. It kind of becomes a dry land crop during that stage and an irrigated crop during the sensitive stages. And here's what we've learned. This is a six-year average of doing that experiment in northern Colorado. Of course, the well-watered system is going to produce the most. But if you're in a water-scarce environment and you irrigate at a normal time sequence that you always would if you had plenty of water, the yields are devastating. But by shifting and saving the water during the non-critical growth stage and applying that same amount of water, even though you've reduced the water down significantly, the yield loss is not as dramatic. And in fact, if I throw the crop water productivity numbers up there, it's actually that middle system, the controlled deficit irrigation, that produces the most crop per drop of water. Not the highest yield, but the highest efficiency of water use. So the principle here, again, is that crop water productivity is dependent on the timing of water stress. And with that, I think I'm going to let Brian come up and give some additional examples.
So I think it's important that we look at a system. And one of the things I'm criticized as well as praised for is that I get involved in a lot of collaborations in a lot of different systems and looking across disciplines. And in particular, I'm going to talk about nutrient management, but some other things as well, and use some real-world examples. I'm very applied in my work, and I'm going to bring in some case studies. Some I have some data on, some are just, you know, just observational. This first case study comes from my days when I was in Nebraska, and no surprise, a corn bean system, and this particular field that I was involved with had serious yield problems year after year after year, and never quite hitting any kind of profitability. We took, you know, and this is actually from many years ago when yield monitors were just kind of coming on, but we were able to do some yield mapping and did a cumulative yield map. This is a six-year map with 3 years of corn, 3 years of beans laid on top of each other. And pretty consistently, we're seeing some trends in this field and some large trends, probably bigger than usual. I'm picking this as a case study because of its extreme nature, but you know, we often see differences like this in fields. Maybe not as at this level of extreme, but we certainly see differences. These differences in this field were primarily related to topography issues. We've had some erosion had occurred over time, and we got some soil depth and calcareousness. Eroded hillside there on the right in those blue areas. Very shallow soils, pretty rocky. With very low water holding capacities. And just, you know, it doesn't matter how much fertilizer or whatever I throw at that, you know, anything short of bringing in topsoil just wasn't getting the job done. The soils are very degraded. So this particular area, it couldn't be eliminated from production, which I'm going to talk about in just a second. That's the primary focus of my case study here. But in this particular system, or part of the field, excuse me, we started doing some other things. We started doing variable rate. We cut the nitrogen rates back tremendously because we're never growing the yields. We just didn't need them. And we did some research. I have some data from that particular location showing that our efforts were good. That's not the emphasis of what I want to talk about today, though. So we improved things there. But I want to focus, though, on, well, also, that nowadays, and we're going to show a little bit of data in a few minutes, it is possible to vary the irrigation in this particular location. We have that technology now. Back then, we really didn't. But let's focus on this other area of the field. Also, a low-yielding area makes up about 4.3% of the field by acreage. This is a set-move irrigation system, which essentially allowed us to just stop farming that corner of the field. And that decision was done based on an economic analysis, trying to look at different parts of the field and where we were making money. In this upper left part of the field, that area was making money every year. The bottom right was losing money every year, so we just cut it out. The result was we had we turned the corner in terms of profitability on this particular field. We also decreased other inputs as well. Bottom line was, in this part of the field, so not including our variable rate and other things that we did, which also improved profitability in this field, we had a 10.1% increase in profitability over this field over the next 2 years. And we had a 5% reduction in water consumption. And then, of course, there would be environmental benefits that some of which we measured in terms of, you know, if I'm growing a crop and I don't have a crop there and I apply at a full rate of nitrogen, obviously I'm going to have some runoff, a leaching, and those types of losses. So it just makes sense for a lot of reasons, profitability being number one for the grower, but also water reductions. Shift gears a little bit. Here's another principle to talk about, is that water and fertility management interact. And I think we, you know, that makes sense to us, but do we really do anything with it? My experience is that most of us don't. We did a little study here, and I'm going to shift gears and talk about turf grass. Not everybody grows corn and beans, but most of us have turf grass or some kind of history of mowing a lawn, at least, so we can maybe relate to that. We did a little study where we looked at two levels of irrigation, 100% ET replacement, so fully irrigated, versus a reduced irrigation at 60% of ET. And then we have three levels of nitrogen as low, optimum, and excessive. And visually you can see the response here. The turf that's underwatered is dark, as per typical, a little bit graying. That's fully irrigated is a little lighter green, but obviously there's a nitrogen response there, particularly with the fully irrigated grass. If we look at the data, this is really interesting, is that the nitrogen impacts the evaporative loss, ET losses, in both cases, whether I'm fully irrigated or whether I'm a deficit irrigation, it's impacting it. And the more nitrogen, the more water loss. So that shouldn't be a surprise to us, but it's something that maybe we don't consider, especially if I'm in a deficit irrigated situation, that nitrogen probably ought to be coming to a reduced amount that's applied. Biomass production as well. Now, in the case of turf grass, I don't want to mow too much. I want my lawn looking good, but I don't want too much biomass. So I'm much more interested in being at that optimum level in the middle. And not only, so I'm saving water, I'm reducing my mowing, I'm cutting back my nitrogen, and all of those things potentially are going to be positives for me in this urban case study. We switch gears back to some cropping in that we've got a case study in Idaho. It's a potato wheat rotation. Legal issues for this particular farm, they have to cut their water back. And so we began looking at a whole variety of scenarios. And, you know, do we stop farming fields or what are we going to do? In this particular case, the decision was to not cut out acreage, but to try to look at best management practices. And we essentially set up a little study where we were comparing whole fields, where I'm going to do these best management practices in four fields. We help the grower manage those fields, and he continued to do his normal practices in the other four paired fields with similar soil and topography, etc. So BMPs, one of the things we did was change varieties. Russet Burbank is number one potato variety in the United States, but it's kind of a weakling. It is very susceptible to diseases, has a very poor root system, it's a water hog. We switched over to some other varieties, such as Alturas, Ranger, which are more water efficient. They also have better yield potential and better water use efficiency because of some rooting issues as well as pathogen resistance. We also did some variable rate fertilization. Nitrogen rates were based on yield maps in terms of yield potential, and aerial imagery was used largely to help make those maps, both bare soil imagery as well as in-season imagery. I'll show you some of that here in a moment. We also varied some of the other nutrients as well based on aerial imagery-driven zone sampling. In terms of our fertilizer nitrogen, how it was applied, that was very important. We switched. This grower had a very sandy soil. He was putting on, you know, about half of his nitrogen pre-plant, and the other half was being irrigated through the season. We convinced him that we could cut that pre-plant amount back because nitrogen demand for potato is very, very low for the first about 40 days of production. And it's just something that, you know, if I catch a rain or I'm irrigating a little excessively, I'm flushing that nitrogen out of that root zone. So we cut him back there. We applied a polymer-coated urea, and we did so variable rate. We did that at emergence and hilling in order to maximize yield potential. In-season nitrogen applications were almost eliminated. We had one case where we according to the petioles, we did need the petiole sample analysis. The tissue suggested we needed additional nitrogen, and we did apply that. But essentially, we're managing our nitrogen very differently in these fields. We hired an irrigation consultant. Previously, this grower was just kind of flying by the seat of his pants, so to speak, as my dad would say. And we actually had put some sensors in the field, and we're using a very knowledgeable, dedicated irrigation consultant who, that was his primary focus. Too often our growers are focused on other things besides irrigation, and, you know, the tractors broke down, or they got to sell the crop, or whatever. And, you know, one of the most important things they need to be doing, especially in a potato crop, potato is extremely sensitive to water, is being neglected. And so having a dedicated person who's an expert in that was something that we implemented. We also applied a surfactant. I won't talk about that. But, you know, and so here's an example of one of these fields where we have some differences. This is an NDVI aerial image, which is, I won't bother to explain what that is, but, you know, the company that we're using is able to look at this and see things that you can't see with the naked eye. If you look at the same area of the field visually, which is on the right, I don't see any problems. It looks healthy. But the NDVI imagery is showing us that we've got some problems in the field. The red is the plants are healthy, happy. These lighter colored areas are areas where we have stress. And it's typically moisture stress. We also have some phosphorus deficiencies in this field as well. Here's another image kind of showing this. I mean, these NDVI images sometimes can be very dramatic in terms of differences across the field. Now I'm looking at that field visually and I don't see any difference. But that using that technology allows me to look at not just the nutrient management, but also look at my water management potential. So when we did this project, we had some negatives. We had our seed costs went up. The Alturas Ranger seed cost more than the Burbank seed. Our management time went up. And our costs went up. Hiring that consultant is part of that. Our nutrient amounts were the same, but our costs for the PCU were increased, and spreading costs were also increased. But our positives were we have documented savings of about 22% reduction in water use, which was huge, and met his goals of what he needed to do in order to continue to farm all of his acres. He had, and the nice surprise was he had increases in yields of about 3.2%, and then that's not true. It's not supposed to be 15.3. It's 5.3 increase in U.S. number one tubers, which is, you know, for this particular grower, that's money for him, is those high-quality tubers. 4.6% net increase in profits when we put all that together. Okay, let me give you another turf grass case study. This is in Utah. Typical irrigation in this case, and what do I mean by typical? Basically, the Utah State did a study showing that the average person in the state of Utah puts on 3 to 4 times more water than they need. So, and believe it or not, turf grass is number one acreage of irrigated species in the United States. And it's the most grossly over-irrigated. So it's something we're focused on. These folks were watering daily 3 times with an automatic sprinkler system. They were applying, and because of that, they were putting on about threefold more water than they really needed. Also using a one-size-fits-all fertilizer company coming in and spraying the same thing everybody else gets, and they were getting about 6 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. And then they were also getting phosphorus, potassium, and the whole bang of nutrients. So they switched over with some guidance from us. Data shows that each of these practices that are known to impact water use efficiency, the things I'm about to show you, they impact rooting depth or efficiency or both, as well as shoot biomass production. So one of those things is we do appropriate mowing height, mowing frequency, raise the mower. Prior to this, they were mowing too low, and so we had them raise their mowing height, and they, which gives me deeper roots. I'll show you that here in a minute. Avoided scalping, appropriate fertilization based on soil tests and sound science. They cut the nitrogen rate in half, used a polymer-coated urea and ammonium sulfate in a 2/3, 1/3 blend. stopped applying other nutrients because the soil test said they didn't need it, and how that impacts water, it's something I could talk about another day, and I don't have time today to do that. But improved irrigation uniformity by looking at maintenance. Bottom line is we develop deeper roots through the following practice. Cutting that nitrogen rate does that. Making sure that I have enough nitrogen in the fall for perennial grass systems, that's the most important time to have the nitrogen in the system. That's when I develop my roots. That's when I develop my root depth. And that's true whether I'm talking turf grass or a forage crop. And we intentionally stress that grass in the spring. And what that does, it sends a physiological signal to the grass that it's time to make roots and go deep. Deep and less frequent irrigation system and stretching times. Bottom line is, instead of watering three times a day, every day, over a period of 2 years, we were finally able to get them to a five-day interval and much more efficient in our water use. If we start looking at these root systems, it's very important to think about my roots. And far too many of us don't understand root architecture, root morphology. And we see all kinds of different rooting patterns in crops as well as in native species and turf grass. You can see here that, if you look at turf compared to almost everything else, we have a very, very shallow root system, which impacts tremendously my water management, my nutrient management, etc. It also changes on a permanent sod, whether we're talking turf or forage grasses. The rooting depth can be altered dramatically through the season. It can more than double in depth. So what bottom line was on that particular case study, the grass is now greener. We're using about 300% less water. It's our most extreme example. We typically don't see those extreme examples with farmers because they can't afford to apply 300 times more water than they need. But in the shallow root urban system, that's a thing that we commonly see. Previously, there were brown spots in July, and those things pretty well stopped, even though we were watering less and less frequently. Rooting depth increased an average of 2 to 3, from an average of 2 to 3 inch depth to double that. And you can see some pictures here in contrast. All right, I'm going to turn time back over to Neil.
All right, thanks, Brian. I just have one more principle that I'd like to lay out. Up to this point, we've talked about crop rotation adjustments to improve water use efficiency. We've talked about baselining with a water production function and how that can help you identify production practices that will improve your water productivity. We've talked about nutrient management as a factor, and then Brian's most recent kind of turf example of other cultural management practices that can be influenced. So I just want to kind of end up with talking about irrigation scheduling. In an irrigated environment, key to maximizing the efficiency of your water use is to regulate your irrigation effectively. And there's a lot of different methods that people use and use pretty effectively. A lot of the crop consultants I interact with have become experts at the soil moisture by feel method, and they visit fields regularly. They go through the rooting zone and pull out soil, and they can kind of assess where that soil is relative to its water holding capacity and make pretty good irrigation recommendations on that. I think those are excellent techniques, and I definitely wouldn't change that if it's being done regularly and by an expert. I already talked about the idea of using reference ET and crop coefficients. This is the idea of having access to a weather station that's in relative good proximity to the irrigated field that you're working on. And from the weather station, you can predict evapotranspiration under a reference crop, and then you adjust that based on a crop coefficient. It's becoming more common now to use some remote sensing techniques. One that we're working on is sensing crop canopy temperature. So using an infrared thermometer or camera, essentially what you're looking at is, it's sort of like when you go to the doctor's office and they take your temperature for a health status. In a crop environment, the evapotranspiration, the movement of water through the leaf, is a cooling process. When water changes phases, it absorbs heat and cools the leaf. So under water stress, if a plant's transpiration is reduced, Either it's closing stomates to biologically conserve water, or water's running short in the soil. Once you reduce the evapotranspiration rate, the leaf temperature is going to go up higher. And so you can detect that with a remote sensing tool. There's people talking about, hey, let's mount this on the center pivot so it's looking out in front of the pivot and assessing crop water status, and maybe in a variable rate irrigation scenario, you can adjust on the fly the irrigation rates accordingly. You could use some kind of a drone or an aerial image to do those. We're finding some pretty good success with those. There are some challenges with remote sensing of temperature. It's very sensitive to the time of day and the angle of the sun. And obviously, if you have clouds, it gives you a different outcome. So there are some challenges with that technique. Other remote sensing methods, spectral reflectance data, can be useful. The one I want to kind of end up discussing here is a project I'm working on together with some colleagues from the company Meter, using soil moisture sensors as an irrigation scheduling technique. And this isn't new. This has been widely used, and it's widely applied by irrigation consultants. But I think this little case study that I want to illustrate with this kind of complicated figure will illustrate some new principles or maybe make you think of it differently. So you're going to have to study this. There's a lot of lines on this chart, and I'll kind of try and walk you through it so you can see what's happening here. On the left, the y-axis is soil volumetric water content. So this is a field, it's under turf grass, where we've buried some sensors. And we've buried water content sensors. These are probably the most common kind of category of sensors used for irrigation scheduling. And so here you can see these lines right here that are kind of sawtooth shaped. This is a water content sensor. It's hovering around, you know, between 18 and 20% water content. During this time period, we were using just an irrigation control clock to turn the sprinklers on, right? Every other day. So every time you see a peak go up, that was the sprinklers coming on, and then it kind of trickled down a little bit over the next 2 days, and then it came back on. There was a little period here where maybe we missed an irrigation or something, but for the most part, you can see the effect of that irrigation every other day. This one here is a deeper soil water content sensor. So this is a shallow one, this is a deeper one, and you can see it's really pretty wet down below and this is just below the root zone of the turf. What you don't see from a water content sensor, you're seeing the effect of drying and wetting. And I think that this has been a significant problem, actually, in my experience interacting with people using sensors to control irrigation or to schedule irrigations, is you really don't know relative to your specific soil what the critical levels are. Is this too wet, too dry? And the key to figuring that out, again, people that are experienced with the feel method have kind of learned this, but using sensors on their own, you actually need a different sensor. You need a measure. What we're expressing over here on the right side is the water potential. So this is the idea of where are we relative to field capacity or wilting point? Are these sawtooth patterns that we're seeing, where are they? So we actually had in this environment buried side by side a water content sensor, that's what I just showed you, and a water potential sensor. And you didn't even notice it because it almost looks like the boundary of the graph, but this dotted line at the very top up here is the outcome for the water potential sensor. And you see no jagged up and down. And if you go across to the right-hand side axis where we're expressing water potential, you're going to see we're very close to a water potential of zero. This is an irrigation environment that was super saturated. Even though you're seeing, and I've seen this, where irrigation advisors have seen water potential, water content changes over time without knowing. Even though they're changing, we're in an extremely wet environment. Okay? So that's what, this is the water potential up here near zero. Okay, so temporally now, here a little into the month of July, we made a shift. We turned off the irrigation clock. Let's shift to where we're going to let the sensors tell us when we should irrigate. And the idea was that We thought with turf we could get down to about negative 300 kilopascals before it would start to show signs of stress. So the idea was we'll just watch these sensors, and when it gets down to about that point, we'll trip on the irrigation. And so here you can see, if you look at the water content, multiple days, we're going down. We've not irrigated for nearly a week. And during that time, the water potential is coming down as well. We got down a little bit below where our target was, but still acceptable. And we tripped on the sprinklers, and so the water potential responded and the water content. So you can see that pattern repeat itself several times here. We got to where we were only irrigating about seven times over as many weeks, almost about one irrigation per week was all that we needed in this environment, whereas the default was, hey, irrigate every other day kind of thing. So the idea here, I guess I'm trying to illustrate, you can schedule irrigation with sensors, but a lot of times just a water content sensor on its own without some additional information or experience is not giving you all the information you need. Now, just for fun, this last period up here, we can debate whether this was done deliberately or accidentally, but we actually dried the soil down to an extreme. So we just wanted to see how these sensors would respond. And so here we dried until the crop stopped taking up water completely. We're kind of like, hey, what is the bottom limit for this turf grass? And we did put the turf grass into dormancy, went brown, but we got down to a little bit less than a negative 1,000 kilopascals of water potential. And what you can see here is that the water content sensors, again, they kind of bottom out when you get down to that point because the plant stops taking up water. So to me, there was a lot of advantage of having some understanding of both water content and water potential in these settings if you're using sensors as your approach to irrigation scheduling. Okay, so I kind of quickly touched on some of these other methods, irrigation scheduling as a final kind of recommendation of how we can maximize the use of water in an irrigated or dry land crop environment. And with that, I'm going to let Brian kind of finish things up for us.
So to me, one of the most important things that we can do, kind of end on this, is that we frequently have irrigation systems that are extremely poorly functioning. I see a lot of aerial imagery, both in our research and in consulting scenarios with growers, and this is common for me to see this type of imagery. Now, this is a visual image. The NDVI, would actually potentially show additional problems, but this is just a visual. And this center pivot irrigation system is just not operating very well. It wasn't installed well. This one doesn't even have swing arms. If it has a swing arm, it typically is even worse. But we've got these wedges that are occurring because the system was either not installed properly or was not maintained properly. I oftentimes see these rings that are occurring. That I've got nozzles that are improperly sized. I've got maybe sometimes entire spans that are sized, or the system is just not functioning properly. This particular real-world example with the grower, and this data is actually a little dated. It's from a few years ago, but significant losses in this particular field in terms of this irrigation system. So we've talked about a lot of things. We've thrown a lot of stuff at you, but we're hoping to cover the waterfront in terms of a lot of different approaches that can be taken to look at water improvements in water use efficiency. As we've mentioned, system level management can improve water productivity. Using water productive function as a baseline comparison tool, something that I don't see growers typically using, but these Australian growers, it would probably be something that we ought to be taking a look at in water-scarce environments. Managing the timing of water availability for critical growth stages. implementing BMPs, in particular nitrogen, is probably the one thing that we really need to be managing carefully and not overdoing it. I showed you some data with turfgrass, but we have all kinds of data with every other crop imaginable, showing that if we overdo it with nitrogen, we're also decreasing our water use efficiency. Irrigation scheduling tools are vital and need to be used, especially in a water-limited environment. Proper installation and maintenance of irrigation systems, and then understanding and attempting to match demand are things that we really need to be doing. So with that, we would open up. We've got a couple minutes for questions, I believe. Alan?
Yeah, so you come up to the mic. So, Brian, you showed some slides showing how excess nitrogen is in turfgrass and increases water consumption, or water stress, I think it was. And Neil, you talked about the concept of skipping irrigation during this non-critical vegetative stage. So, can we put those two together? And if we're going to skip irrigation during that non-critical vegetative stage, should we also hold off on the nitrogen during that stage as well? Because Brian showed that the excess N is going to increase that stress. So should we be putting those two together?
Yeah, it's an excellent question and comment, and the answer is yes. You know, if you're in one of these controlled deficit irrigation scenarios and you're putting a lot of nitrogen on up front, you're telling it to grow with the nitrogen, and you're holding back the water, and it's not going to help you achieve your goal. So the idea is we've got to get the nitrogen management to time right, but the growth is going to be sort of proportional to the water availability, and we'd like the nitrogen to match the pattern of the nitrogen availability and supply to match that. And so, yeah, exploring tools to how to time that nitrogen availability, to me, is a key part of improving the water productivity. You know, we've known for years that irrigation management translates to nitrogen use efficiency. We've got to avoid leaching so we're not losing nitrogen. But I think the inverse is true as well, that to get better water use efficiency, we've got to control the nitrogen supply rate and timing.
I'll just quickly say we did some work with potato on that very thing, and I agree it's vital. And in a potato, we've done some deficit irrigation in potato, and putting on even a normal amount of nitrogen just submarined our yields. But if we were a little stingy at the beginning and then made sure we had adequate nitrogen towards the end, it was really that timing of that nitrogen was critical. Other questions? Thank you.